When the Buddha taught the five brethren, his very first disciples, and the most senior among them, Venerable Gongchenya, gained the Dharma eye, became a stream enterer. The first thing he did was to ask to become a member of the Sangha. Here he was, already a member of the noble Sangha. But he wanted to become a member of the conventional Sangha as well. And the Buddha immediately said yes, invited him to become a monk, to practice, to put an end to suffering. So the Sangha was established almost immediately after the Dharma was first proclaimed and was shown to be effective. It shows that the Buddha was very far-sighted, that for the Dharma to stay in the world would require a social institution of a particular kind. And it was over the years that you began to see how this institution was shaped, how his vision shaped it. When he had about 60 disciples, all of them arahants, he sent them out to teach. He said, do this with sympathy for the well-being of the many human beings, devas, who would benefit from hearing this Dhamma. They were sent out as almsmen. In other words, they were going to live off people's gifts, which meant that they could teach the Dhamma as a gift. It wasn't an exchange. It's not, you feed me, I will teach you the Dhamma. They taught the Dhamma to many people who hadn't fed them. But the fact that they lived off gifts meant that they could give the Dhamma freely. And their virtuous conduct made them, as the Buddha said, the unexcelled field of merit for the world. Anyone who wanted to give a gift to this institution, members of this institution, would benefit greatly from that. Just as with a good field, you plant the seeds and you get abundant crops. Now there's no tit for tat there. You give me X amount of food and I will teach you X amount of Dhamma. Both sides have to give freely. And this institution, against all odds, has survived now more than 2,600 years. It's not just against the odds, it's against people who want to privatize the Dharma. But we've seen in the past what happens. When the Mahayana was established, one of the aspects of Mahayana, early Mahayana, that people don't like to talk about, was insistence in the early Mahayana texts that the Dharma that the Mahayana teachers were giving was so valuable that you could never pay them enough. In other words, it wasn't the case that the Dharma was so priceless that you could not think of putting a price on it. It was so priceless that you had to keep on paying. And as the Dharma becomes an object that you can buy, it becomes subject to market forces. The same with the Vajrayana. And now today, people are saying, let's do away with the Sangha, do away with the idea that the Dharma should be priceless. Allow it to be taught for a price. And of course that makes it an object subject to market forces. And the Dharma is sure to suffer. So we all have to do our part to make sure that this institution, this economy of gifts, continues. And there are people who are inspired by it. It's the responsibility of the monks to be inspiring, after all, to be an object of someone else's generosity. The Buddha says the ideal object of generosity either is free of passion, aversion, or delusion, or is practicing for the sake of freeing him or herself from passion, aversion, and delusion. This is how you keep the Sangha alive. You make that your goal. Passion arises, what can you do to get rid of it? Aversion arises, what can you do to get rid of it? And when you recognize that you're deluded, how can you replace that delusion with knowledge? Of course, as you pursue this goal, you're going to benefit. But at the same time, the people who have supported you will benefit as well, and the Sangha gets continued. And the values of the Dhamma get embodied. I remember when I first went to Thailand years back. I arrived in the middle of the night. I woke up the next morning, looked out my hotel window, and there was a monk going for alms. He stopped in front of a store. And the woman in charge of the store went back into the store, came out, put some food in his bowl, and then he went on. It was almost like they belonged to a subversive society, because they were doing something that went against the values of any material culture, where the emphasis is on gaining wealth. Here we represented a tradition where the value was not in wealth, it was in the Dharma. And she, in the midst of her daily activities, had an opportunity to support it. So even though she was pursuing wealth herself, she saw the value of having in the society people who were not pursuing wealth, who were willing to live off gifts, whatever the gifts may be. And it's liberating for both sides. On the side of the monk, think of Venerable Bhatia, who had been a king before he ordained. He would go sit under a tree and say, "What bliss, what bliss." And his fellow monks were concerned. And maybe he was thinking about it, the bliss of being a king, that he missed it. So they told the Buddha. The Buddha probably knew what was going on, but he decided to call Bhatia and to question him, so Bhatia would have a chance to tell his motivation. And it turned out he was saying the bliss he was thinking about was not the bliss of being a king. In fact, when he was a king, he had guards posted inside the palace, outside the palace, inside the city, outside the city, inside the countryside, outside the countryside. And even then he couldn't sleep for fear that someone would try to kill him. Because as a king you're trying to amass wealth. Once you've got it amassed, then you're in danger. But now, he said, he sat under a tree. His needs were provided by what was given. And his mind was free like that of a wild deer. So he's not in a position of taking anything from anyone. He's living off what was offered. There would be no one else to try to push him out of that position. So as monks, we have to be happy with what we receive as gifts. And that keeps us safe and keeps our minds free. At the same time, the more we free our minds, the more we do become an excelled field of merit for the world. I was recently reading an article where someone was saying that the whole idea of merit was something that was invented by the monks as a way of fooling people into supporting them. It had nothing to do with the Buddhist teachings, and it was high time that we got rid of the concept. But actually the Sangha was designed in such a way as to facilitate people in making merit, to provide an opportunity for people to devote their lives to the practice. They become ideal recipients. And in their example, they inspire other people to be generous, be virtuous, to have goodwill for all. After all, the principles that merit is based on are the principles of karma that the Buddha saw in his second knowledge from the night of his awakening. They're intrinsic to the Dhamma. The practice of merit is the first answer to the Buddha's question that lies at the beginning of discernment. What when I do it will lead to my long-term welfare and happiness? What is skillful? What is blameless? Looking for happiness in generosity, looking for happiness in virtue and in universal goodwill. That's a blameless way of looking for happiness. And so the Sangha is designed in such a way as to facilitate that. So as monks, we should practice in a way to make ourselves worthy of people's gifts. We do that by focusing on our practice, training the mind in an institution that places the training of the mind as its bottom line. In economics, the economics of buying and selling, it gets pushed off to the side. The fact that the Dharma is supported by gifts is what keeps it pure, keeps it in line with its original principles, and keeps it immune to the fads of the day. It's in this way that the Dharma is timeless, and we help maintain it in its timeless form. So even if we're not teaching the Dharma per se, we're giving a gift of Dharma to the world.